in service to his people, to free them from exile, from the mud and the blood that only we are forced to suffer. We fight and die, while the Myrillith, Umalin, Nilnyad, Elwyn, and Gwaedrai all enjoy the benefits of our sacrifice. Even the Ascendwar are allowed to return across the Nidwalden. Only the Instaria are banned from our ancestral home. Why is that?
Because it is the Fane's decision, not yours,
Petrogar shouted. His voice sounded thin and reedy.
Indeed!
Nephron was really starting to appreciate Petrogar's assistance. The weeping willow of Afrey possessed the unexpected virtue of making him look good, a gift Nephron loved more than all others.
Because the Fane has decreed that we who shoulder the greatest burden, should receive scorn and humiliation as our reward. Those of you who are in Estremnadon, those who witnessed my father's challenge can attest to this. Were those the acts of an honourable Fane who respects his people? Or did he act the tyrant, imposing his rule through terror?
Sikar! Petrogar yelled. Arrest him! Get him off that box!
Sikar hesitated. They really hate him. This might be easier than I expected.
Let me explain why I came.
Nephron softened his tone and said, I am here to rescue you. All of you. Alanrist is the only home I've ever known. The Instaria, my family. I've come to save you.
You're the one who needs saving,
Petrogar growled, pushing forward through unresponsive ranks.
For many years, I have warned that the runes are capable of combat equal to the skill of the Frey. Few believed.
He focused on Sikar.
I was proven correct when Shigon was killed while on patrol at the Forks. Shigon was murdered while he lay unconscious,
Sikar said.
Doesn't matter. I personally witnessed a rune warrior kill Grindel. Slaughtered him with a perfect blow to the neck, severing his head from his shoulders. You remember Grindel, don't you?
This drew a reaction from every face, including Sikar's. He turned, and like many others, looked at Petrogar.
Is that true? Sikar asked.
I was told that something...
Arun killed Grindel, and you didn't tell us.
And Grindel wasn't unconscious at the time,
Nephron said.
If that's not enough, then know that I myself have fought the runes, and in Wren I was nearly killed in a one-on-one battle. Only the timely intervention of Sebek saved me.
He paused and looked at Sebek, who nodded. This brought even greater expressions of shock to those gathered.
"Then you have lost your skill,"
Petrogar said as he shoved past the remaining shields to join Sikar. The Lord of the Rist shouted in frustration.
"Draw your weapon and take them into the Donjon, or kill them where they stand. But do it now, or you'll be accused of defying the Fane and will be prosecuted as one of them."
Sikar recoiled from Petrogar's rant. He made a miserable face, then sighed and reached for his weapon.
"You don't want to do that," Tekchin said.
"Shut up!"
Sikar pulled his sword, as if it weighed more than Grigor.
"For once, can't you just shut up?"
"I know it's hard to believe," Nephron told Sikar. "But this time Tekchin's right. Put the sword away."
"I can't."
Sikar shook his head.
"You shouldn't have come back."
Sikar was a good soldier, which meant he was no free thinker. He was a strong pair of arms for whoever pulled the strings, and at that moment the puppet master was Petrogar. Time to snip those cords.
"Before you order my friends to kill us,"
He spoke slowly, clearly, and loudly, as he unrolled the ruddy red face of the flag.
"Let me show you one more thing that you might not have noticed. There's no need for your theatrics. We've already seen the ragged band of runes you travelled with," Sekar said.
"You saw only the ones I wanted you to know about." Nephron spoke to Sekar. "Let me introduce the ones I didn't."
Nephron waved the flag over his head. In the distance, horns replied. Nephron didn't turn, didn't need to. Everything that happened behind him was reflected in the wide-eyed faces of those before him. Even Sekar's mouth opened. Petrogar appeared as if he might faint.
"Seal the gate! Seal the gate!" Petrogar cried.
"Wouldn't do that either."
Tekchin grinned.
"Once more, Tekchin defies the odds by being correct."
Nephron stopped waving and lowered the flag.
"What you are looking at are 5,000 battle-hardened, Durg-armed Gularoon warriors. And before you start thinking the walls of Alenrist will save you, consider this. We also have a Miraleth."
"Miraleth?"
Sekar and Petrogar said together, and like an echo in a cavern, the word was repeated throughout the crowd.
"You know her as Arion, the tutor of the prince."
"She was sent to arrest you,"
Petrogar said.
"Changed her mind. Even she recognizes that the Fane has gone mad."
"And the Fane sent giants to punish her for that error in judgment."
"A giant mistake,"
Tekchin chuckled. Nephron smiled and shook his head.
"Yeah, that didn't work out so well for the giants. They're dead now, and she's working with us. So closing those gates won't help. She'll blow them open, or simply tear down your walls."
"You're lying,"
Petrogar said.
Nephron turned to the Galantians.
"On your honour, speak the truth before your brethren and our Lord Ferrol. Is the Miraleth Arion, former tutor of the prince, in our company by her choice, and assisting us in our endeavours?"
Together, in one voice, the Galantians replied,
"Yes, by our honour."
"You're lying!"
Petrogar howled. "They're all lying!"
Irritated beyond the ability to keep quiet, Ellison turned and faced him.
"These are Galantians!"
"And they're liars!"
His voice was a shrill rattle.
"Don't say that again,"
Sekar said, setting his jaw so that his words were forced through his teeth.
"Don't you tell Lord Petrogar what to do!"
Vertimus spoke up.
"Petrogar is in command here!"
"That's right,"
Petrogar said.
"I am in charge. These Galantians are wanted heretics and traitors, and are to be returned to Estranodon, or, if they resist, they will be executed. This is the will of the Fane."
He faced Sekar.
"Do your duty."
"The war is going to begin here," Nephron told Sekar. "I can't allow this fortress to stand if it stands against me."
"You can't ask us to kill our own. Even if the Fane is a poor choice to rule, Ferrol's law still stands.
I'm not asking you to do anything."
Nephron began rolling the flag up again.
"In fact, I want you to do absolutely nothing."
This was the key to the lock that Nephron inserted and prepared to turn. He could see the surprise and, more importantly, the eager interest in Sekar's eyes. The soldier was trapped between duty and honour, desperate for a way out.
"Nothing. I don't under—"
"I said arrest or kill him!"
Petrogar barked,
causing Elisan to roll his eyes.
"I'm the leader of the Instaria,"
Nephron responded to Sekar, ignoring Petrogar. "I don't ask my people to do anything I am not willing to do myself.
and I'm not willing to break Ferrol's law. If I were, do you honestly think he'd still be alive?
Nephron used the rolled flag to point at Petrigar.
All I am asking is that you don't get in the way. Just stay out of it. If you need to, simply report to the Fane that you were overwhelmed, that you had no choice but to surrender to a vastly superior force certain to slaughter every last Frey in Alan Rist, which, I'm afraid, is the truth of the matter. That's why I brought them. Why they're here. The runes are here to absolve you, to expunge any concerns about tarnishing your honour.
Sakaar narrowed his eyes.
What is your plan?
Stop listening to him!
Petrigar gave Sakaar a shove from behind, which anyone who knew Sakaar even a little would recognize as a mistake. The captain of the guard brought his elbow around and slammed it into Petrigar's jaw. The Frey screamed, staggered, and fell. Without looking back, Sakaar addressed Nephron again.
How do you see this working?
The runes are in total revolt. The Gula and the Rulin. They've united and appointed a Keenig.
Yes, we know,
Ellison said, looking past the Galantians toward the hills. The runes will be the arms we shall use to make the Fane understand reason, Nephron explained, or the swords by which we will replace him.
But this is...
Sakaar looked pained.
I hate to say it, but Petrigar is right. What you're doing is treason. And what the Myrilith have done to the Instaria is what? Right. My father tried to follow the rules. He obeyed the laws, and you saw what happened. Do you think Ferrol, who gave us the horn, intended that one tribe should be forever dominant? What's the point of the horn, then? The Myrilith will never give up power. And who can hope to succeed in single combat against one?
Sakaar and Ellison shared a look, and while it was slight, Nephron was certain he saw Ellison nod.
So, what do you say? Nephron asked. Will you turn your back on Ferrol and learn to worship the Myrilith as your new gods, or will you trust me, a fellow Instaria who was raised to lead this tribe by a father who gave his life to save us from these so-called gods?
Bastard! My jaw broke again!
Petrigar slurred. He'd only managed to make it back up to his knees, and crouched on the ground holding his face, tears in his eyes. Sakaar turned fully around, but did not even look at Petrigar. He faced the gathered Instaria and said,
"The Fane has ordered us to apprehend or kill these Frey. Nephron asks us to stay our hands. The Fane is our ruler. The Galantians, our family. In this, I am inclined to side with family, and I'm willing to recognize Nephron, son of Zephyron, as the rightful lord of the Rist."
"I concur," Ellison said. "But, as it is against the will of the Fane, no one can be ordered to do likewise."
Sakaar nodded and backed up, clearing the path to the bridge and the Galantians.
"Any Frey who doesn't wish to defy the Fane's orders, you are free to draw your weapon and do what you believe is your duty."
Sakaar took a few more steps away from the bridge, and made a show of waiting for those loyal to the Fane. Petrigar, still clutching his face, shifted his head, looking around.
"Ooh it!"
he shouted when no one moved.
"Obey your Fane!"
Still, no one moved. After several minutes of stillness, and a silence that was broken only by the desperate outbursts of Petrigar, Sakaar nodded.
"So be it."
Then he turned back to Nephron. "Welcome back, my lord."
"What do you think that means?"
Krugan asked, when most of the Galentians and the defending Frey disappeared inside the gates of the fortress. Only Tek-Chin and Grigor walked back across the bridge.
"They didn't kill them," Lippitt said. "That's got to be a good sign."
"Yes?" Persephone was already descending the narrow, dusty trail, wondering how fast she could safely move. She wanted to be at the bottom, wanted to learn what transpired, and was wondering why she'd climbed up in the first place.
"What happened?"
Moya was the first to greet her. Her big eyes loomed larger than usual.
"Did they fight? Did Suri do something?"
The mystic looked at her, surprised.
"No to both questions. But we don't know exactly what happened."
Persephone slipped on a loose stone, 2 feet from the bottom, stumbled, but landed safely on the hard scrubble plain. She touched down within the gathering of the chieftain's shields. They had all remained there, after Wraith explained there wasn't room for everyone at the top.
"Tek-Chin and Grigor are on their way back, I hope with good news."
"Tek-Chin?"
"Yes, Moya," Persephone rolled her eyes. "Your boyfriend is fine."
"Just asking, Madam Koenig," she said crisply. "Don't call me that. Everyone else does." "No, they don't."
Persephone pushed past Oz and Edgar, grabbed the hem of her skirt, and trotted down the slope to the road. From there she saw the two Galantians striding toward her. The gathered clansmen, a mixture of Wren, Tyre, and Warwick men, flowed in behind, all curious for news.
"Madam Koenig,"
Tek-Chin greeted her with a modest bow. Persephone scowled.
"What happened?"
"We're in."
"What do you mean by that?"
Tek-Chin made a lavish wave of his arm in the direction of Alan Rist.
"Welcome to your new fortress. I think you'll find it more suitable than East Puddle."
"My fortress?"
Tek-Chin laughed.
"Madam Koenig, weren't you watching? You just conquered Alan Rist."
Chapter 3. The Rist. We traded dirt and rough-hewn logs for marble and glass. The Book of Brin. The other times Persephone had been to Alan Rist, she'd stuck close to Reglan, and neither were prone to wander. No one wandered inside Frey territory, much less in the heart of their principal stronghold, whose largest tower had come to symbolize a monolithic sentinel. During those early visits, the procession of chieftains marched across the Grandford Gorge under guard. When the men were led to a meeting hall, the women, those allowed to come, waited in nearby rooms. Persephone had marveled at the lamps, windows, curtains, and furniture. She didn't dare set foot out of the little apartment. None of the women did. They weren't offered a midday meal, and all the runes ate the evening meal together. On her second visit, Persephone and Gala, who she had assumed was Lippitt's wife, only to later discover that she was his mistress, dared to climb the stairs to the window level, where they peered out at an unprecedented view of the great dome, the beautiful city below, and the massive tower that rose higher than she thought possible. No one had stopped them. No one so much as looked their way. But she'd been scared to death. They only had the courage to approach the one window, but that view had stayed with her. She'd had dreams where she walked the city's paved streets, visiting the pillared shops. She was never frightened in her dreams. No one could see her, and somehow she knew this. Persephone had never once believed those dreams would come true in waking life. The day Nephron became Lord of Alan Rist, he spent the afternoon providing Persephone with a personal tour of the fortress that would be her new home. The outpost wasn't as large as she had thought. The majestic fortification crowned the pinnacle of the crag, appearing as the inevitable conclusion to the natural rock. The city, formed of lighter stone and some wood, spilled out below. These smaller buildings trickled down the hillside in tiers, curling around the base of the butte like the tail of a dragon around a hoard of gold.
"And that is Myrtrelin." Nephron pointed to a nondescript open door in a cluster of three-story buildings.
"Land of Mirth?"
Nephron smiled in surprise. "Your Freya's very good." He nodded. "Myrtrelin is..."
He stopped walking and stood in the middle of the street, thinking.
"I don't know if you have such things in Rulin. It's a place where people go to drink and sing songs and tell tales. We do that in our lodges. This is less formal. A place common people can come and relax. Most enjoyable. The Galantians and I spent many a long night in there."
"Seems small. Why come down here when you have that grand dome that I imagine could accommodate the whole town?"
"The Varenthian is our tribal chamber, our general assembly hall. A smaller version of the Arenthian, where the leading officers of the various spears discuss issues and advise the Rist commander."
Persephone smiled politely. "I see.
You don't have a clue what I just said, do you?" "You said that dome building is your lodge, only you don't drink there."
Nephron laughed.
"Okay, yes, I suppose that's about right." "Wouldn't work in Rulin," she told him, as the two began walking again. "Can't call a meeting if there isn't food and drink. No one would come." He laughed again.
A nice laugh, she thought, and generous. Persephone often saw humour and laughter, the good sort, as a gift that both the giver and receiver enjoyed equally.
The humourless she viewed as misers. Most of the men she knew were far too serious, which made Nephron a ray of sunshine through a grim canopy. The city wasn't at all like her dreams. The real thing was far less perfect and much more amazing. The complexity of twisting streets paved in flat stones, the pretty arched bridges, the brightly painted multi-storied homes with their tall windows and dark wood trim were all things beyond her imagination. But she had been surprised to find piles of manure, broken pots, unconscious drunks sleeping on stoops, lewd graffiti, and the smell of urine, which was unmistakable on the narrower streets. But the biggest difference between dream and reality was that all the inhabitants could see her. Everyone stared. Those gathering water from the fountain forgot what they were doing. They stood frozen, watching as Nephron and Persephone passed. Conversations halted, doors closed, laughter died. In every face she saw fear, mingled with revulsion and disbelief. One Frey openly cried. Nephron didn't appear to see any of it as he continued his tour, pointing out landmarks and curiosities in a proud, positively jaunty manner.
"I won't take you up there."
He pointed toward a narrow lane that ran uphill underneath a bridge that joined two three-story buildings.
"But there is a wonderful bathhouse up that way."
"Bathhouse?"
"Where you go to bathe, to steam, to socialize."
"None of those words seem at all related." Another warm laugh. Persephone was apparently the goddess of humor that day.
"Trust me, it's very nice. You'll love it."
"I'm sure I will," she lied. They'd returned to the stairs and were on their way back. The tour was coming to an end, but Persephone had a few questions she needed answered before they rejoined the rest. When they reached the first landing, they were alone, so she seized the opportunity. Nephron was a warrior, and she thought he'd appreciate a direct approach.
"So, what happens now?"
Caught by surprise, Nephron turned to discover he'd left her behind.
"I thought I'd show you around the fortified areas. Not the Spy Rock, that takes too long to climb, but I think, I mean, now that we've taken Alan Rist."
She toggled her index finger between them. "What happens now?"
"You're the Keenig. You tell me."
"I'm not an idiot," she said. "This is a huge victory for you."
"For us?"
She rolled her eyes. "This won't work if you continue to treat me like a child." He peered at her sidelong, his mouth partly open. He licked his lips, then his tongue lingered, touching his front teeth. "You planned this," she said.
"Of course I did.
You were there when..." "No, you planned this before you ever came to Wren."
He stopped.
Again the contemplative stare. "You've plotted this maneuver for months, maybe years, but you didn't count on me. You expected to be the Keenig of the Ten Clans."
Still, Nephron didn't say anything, but his face shifted to genuine interest, perhaps for the first time in her presence. She wanted to think there was respect as well, but maybe she saw only what she wanted.
"When you came to Dal Ren, you said you were outlawed because you wouldn't carry out the Thane's edicts and refused to destroy the Rune Dals. You expressed outrage at the other Instaria who destroyed Dorea and Nadak, killing every villager. But I'm not buying that. Your assistance wasn't because of moral outrage over the slaughter of innocents."
He didn't try to refute her, so she went on.
"I don't know. Maybe you do have a genuine aversion to butchering women and children. Or perhaps killing is a mindless habit for you. As easy to do as it is for Padera to snap the neck of a chicken. But you didn't give up your heritage. Leave all this..." She gestured at the city. "Because a few houses were burned, a few babies killed. Such an act would take far more compassion than I think you're capable of feeling. Honestly, I don't care. What I do care about is what your plans are now. How do you see this grand adventure of yours playing out?"
"How do you think I see it?"
Persephone stepped to the handrail and looked down on the roof of a home that had a flower and vegetable garden on top. The plants were doing well for such a hot summer. "I think this bloodless victory, the capture of a fortress that my people believe to be impregnable, establishes you as a worthy hero among the Ten Clans. You're gaining trust and allegiance. Another similar success, and you might not need me at all. You might already feel I'm unnecessary." She looked behind her, and these stairs are very steep.
"They are," he said,
then surprised her by holding out his hand.
She stared at it suspiciously.
He smiled at her hesitation, lowered his hand, and began to nod.
"You're smarter than I gave you credit for, but I'm probably not the only one to underestimate you. I suppose I could lie. I could insist you are wrong and reaffirm my devotion to the cause of saving the runes, but I suspect you'd see through that. You're a hard woman to lie to."
"No, people have no trouble lying to me. The hard part is making me believe. So, what happens next? What are your plans for me?" Nephron ran fingers through his hair, leaving his hand to linger on the back of his neck.
"Okay, I was planning to tell you this in a more appropriate time and place."
He looked around the steps and shrugged. "But since you insist, it was my hope to marry you." Persephone's mouth dropped open. Conquering the Premier Frey stronghold in a matter of minutes without the loss of a single life,
paled in comparison to her shock at that single sentence.
Marry me?
You do that, right? Runes have marriage?
Yes, we do, but we...
She once more toggled her finger between them.
Don't.
Why not? Don't tell me there is a rune law against that, too. She opened her mouth, but the number of possible ways to answer that question jammed in their flood to escape and left her speechless.
In Frey society, most marriages are arrangements of convenience. They advance social status, grant access to certain circles, form needed alliances. Rarely are they romantic. This is what I'm proposing.
He's proposing.
To win this war, we need to join forces. I need credibility in the eyes of the clans. Without it, I have no means to fight. You need the support of the Instaria, which I can obviously provide. My recognized authority will bring all the Avalon outposts to heel. Our marriage would bind these two otherwise antagonistic groups into an extremely effective and overwhelming force. Your numbers, my guidance and resources. He wove his fingers together in front of him. Together, we would become the knot at the confluence of two ropes, forming a line strong enough to pull up the whole world.
Or enough rope to hang ourselves with.
That too.
He smiled. There was an amazing power about him, and his smile was warm, friendly, inviting. But is it genuine? Well, at least he's not treating me like a child anymore.
There's no need to give an answer now. I'd prefer if you didn't. Like I said, this wasn't the time and place of my choosing. Let's get settled in. Get to know each other better. Then we can revisit the topic.
Revisit the topic? He's really pouring on the charm.
And yet, she found his practical approach appealing. She had rejected Wraith's overtures because they were based on selfish desire. He wanted her all to himself, for them to run away and live a fantasy on a hill overlooking the Urdum River. She had no doubt Wraith loved her. She remembered what that looked like, how it felt. But love was for the young, the innocent, and the stupid. She couldn't see herself putting those blinders on again. She had a job to do, and that was more important than her own happiness. She held no illusions about Nephron, and he appeared to see her just as clearly. Persephone had little interest in being a wife again, but a partner, an equal partner. That was something else. She looked at the Frey Lord appraisingly. He was more than attractive. He was beautiful, godlike. And yet if he tried to kiss her, she thought she might scream. They weren't even the same race. The whole idea was absurd, and yet his logic was irrefutable.
"Come on," he said. "We need to get back. I don't want Moya hunting me down with that giant bow of hers."
"Thank you," she told him.
He paused, puzzled. "For telling me the truth," she explained. He smiled again. A nice smile.
"That's where I used to live."
Malcolm pointed at a beautiful home, its door ornamented with a bronze handle and a decorative knocker in the shape of a sword striking a shield. Wraith had never seen anything like it, aside from the countless other homes they had passed. The street was perfectly straight and paved in flat stones with such precision that no weeds could grow between the cracks. The only visible dirt to be found was packed in planters, which produced vegetables and herbs.
"You live there?"
Tesh asked.
"That's Shigon's old house. Meryl and I both worked here." He didn't need two servants after his wife left, but he kept us both on anyway.
You lived here, and you ran away?
Tesh's eyes widened.
Is the inside a fancy torture chamber or something?
The inside is lovely. An artful clover motif reflected in the curved archways, as well as the spring colours.
Tesh just stared at him. Malcolm chuckled. I wasn't there long. I used to serve in the fortress.
They both looked up toward the Spyrock. That's what Malcolm called the insanely tall watchtower, linked to the Kype by a giant bridge. Upon seeing it for the first time, Gifford had described the tower as looking like Mara had been tending her garden and left her shovel jammed in the dirt. That's what the potter meant to say, at least, but because of his inability to pronounce the or sound, what he said was, "Looks like Mara left the shovel in the garden."
"That's where they tortured you?" Tesh asked. "In the fortress?"
"No one mistreated me."
"Didn't even beat you?"
"No."
"Starved you?"
Malcolm shook his head and frowned.
"They must have done something pretty awful for you to run from this. I know families who'd sell their firstborn to live here."
Again, Tesh looked at Wraith, who supported him with a nod. Having already gone through this conversation with Malcolm, Wraith wasn't as shocked, but there was a difference between what he'd pictured and reality. Usually, Wraith's imagination outstripped the real world. Not this time. Tesh had worried eyes, as if this was the part of the dream where monsters closed in and the door to safety refused to open. He'd had that look ever since they crossed the Granford Bridge. The kid was swimming in a pool of deadly snakes, waiting for the first one to bite. Wraith understood. He felt it too. These were their enemies, the evil gods who'd butchered their people. And he and Tesh were strolling their streets as if they owned the place. They didn't. The 10 clans had done nothing to earn this right. The Frey had invited them in. Spiders did the same to flies.
"How many families live there with you?" Tesh asked.
"None," Malcolm replied. "Just Chagon, me, and Merrill."
The ex-slave tilted his head with a puzzled look.
"The plants are doing well. I wonder who lives there now."
"What made Chagon leave the fortress?"
Wraith asked him. "Chagon was never in the fortress. He was from the Ascendwar tribe, not in the guard. Very few non-Instaria are."
"I thought you said you were in the fortress."
"Oh, yes." Malcolm nodded. I had a different master then."
"He sold you?"
"Died."
"Died?"
"You of all people should know Frey do that."
"How old was he?"
Malcolm shrugged.
15, 16, maybe."
"That young?"
100. 1500 or 1600.
"Oh, okay. I always wondered how long they lived."
"He didn't die of old age."
"Accident?"
Wraith looked up at the walkways between the massive tower and the dome. A fall from either of them would kill anyone.
"He was killed in combat."
Wraith couldn't imagine what sort of beings killed Frey, prior to him at least. Giants? Goblins? A dragon? Likely it was something he'd never heard of. Seeing the inside of Alan Rist made Wraith realize how limited his understanding of the world was. The three paused at the city square, near a big well with a little roof to protect those using it from sun or rain.
"How long did it take them to build all this?" Tesh asked.
Malcolm shrugged. 1,000 years or so."
"It's so beautiful."
"Where are all the people?" "Hiding."
Malcolm dipped a hand into the fountain's pool and wiped his face.
"The barbarians have entered the gates. The residents have no idea what might happen. This is unprecedented, and likely terrifying.
They're scared, Tesh said. The elves are scared of us.
When we arrive by the thousands, and the Rist's guards let us wander their streets, yes. These people have been told that we're wild, little more than mindless animals. I suppose they expect we're here to loot, pillage, and burn. So goes the planting, so comes the harvest, Wraith said.
He stood up on the rim of the well and looked out. The place was fine, to be sure, but a bit too orderly. This was a home built by warriors, for warriors. It lacked the flowers and winding paths of Wren. To the south, over the orange clay roofs, he located the river gorge. At Granford, the Burn River flowed through a canyon. Somewhere down that way, the Burn joined forces with the Urum at a place known as the Forks, the place he'd buried his father.
The Gula still might have a mind to do a bit of pillaging. I suspect that's why Nephron asked them to remain camped in what's left of Dorea, Malcolm said. Not going to like that. Probably disappointed there was no battle. I know several who were looking forward to killing those they previously believed to be gods.
I just can't believe the elves are scared of us, Tesh said.
Frey, Wraith corrected. These ones are on our side now. At least that's the story Nephron is spreading.
Not all of them are frightened,
Tesh said, pointing in the direction of the house Malcolm had lived in.
Wraith recognized Merrill, Malcolm's one-time partner in servitude, the coward who'd ridden away while screaming, "Murderer, murderer!" Merrill stepped out of the too-pretty-to-be-true house, and leaving the door wide, took four steps.
This left him still in the front yard, still behind the little decorative wall. He glared at them from his tiny battlement.
"Merrill!" Malcolm greeted him happily and walked over.
"Murderer!" Merrill shouted back in Frey.
Malcolm stopped.
"I didn't kill..."
Wraith didn't catch everything they said. They spoke quickly in Frey. All he caught were the words bloodthirsty, cannibalism, and monsters. He wasn't even certain of those due to Merrill's thick accent. Malcolm was trying to calm his old roommate. Wraith didn't need to understand the words to know that, but Merrill was having none of it. He shouted his replies and grew more red-faced with each round. Before long, he was slapping the top of the wall. Other doors opened. Ghostly faces materialized at windows. Frey couples appeared on balconies. From the third floor of what looked to be a leather shop, Wraith heard a reedy Frey say,
"Please come away. It's dangerous."
More were coming out, standing on stoops with folded arms, stiff lips, and nodding heads.
"Maybe we should move on," Wraith said. "Let's head back and find Moya and Tekchin. Or maybe Roan needs a hand with the wagons."
Wraith tugged on Malcolm's sleeve. The ex-slave waved back at him with one hand. As he did, Wraith noticed another pair of eyes, looking down from the upper-story window of Merrill's house. Remembering Malcolm's question about who lived there now, Wraith tilted his head up for a better look, and the figure withdrew into the shadows. All that remained was the flutter of a curtain. It took a full-out drag by his wrist to get Malcolm walking, but Wraith outweighed his friend by no small amount, and Malcolm soon gave in to the idea.
"Idiot," Malcolm grumbled. "He's completely forgotten who he is. He actually thinks being a slave is a privilege. A privilege! Can you believe that? And he refuses to even admit he's human, or Rune, as he so derisively refers to us. The little
partisan bigot. Traitor is what he is.
Malcolm marched up the street with loud slaps of his feet.
You used to think of us as runes, too. That's before I knew better.
Malcolm jabbed his pointed finger at Wraith.
See? Right there. I can be reasoned with. But not him. Oh, no. Not Merrill, the little weasel. He knows, he thinks he knows, everything, except that he's no better than anyone else. I honestly don't know how the man manages to dress himself in the morning.
Malcolm continued to fume, but more quietly, as they rounded a wall painted with crude images.
So, did you find out who his new master is? Doesn't have one, Malcolm said. He empties chamber pots in the Kype and cleans out cells in the Dergeon now. Not too happy about the change. Blames me for tarnishing his otherwise impeccable reputation. I don't know what he's complaining about. He still gets to live in one of the best houses in the city, and he has the whole place to himself.
Then who was that in there with him?
Merrill made it very clear he was alone, and how it was my fault he was now a pariah.
I saw someone upstairs. Malcolm looked at him skeptically.
Really? Why would Merrill lie about something like that?
Wraith shrugged.
Take it up with him next time we never come down here again.
Okay.
Nephron just gifted us this pretty place. Might not be a good idea to get exiled before we've tasted the veal.
This made Malcolm smile.
They do have wonderful veal.
Chapter 4 Council of the Koenig. Persephone was my hero. I'm proud to say she was also my friend, nearly a second mother. She was also the Koenig, but that was just a word, just a title that did not mean anything until she stood beneath that dome and we heard the thunder of her voice. The Book of Brynn.
Nephron called the meeting. Persephone had told him they needed to sit down and talk with representatives of Alan Rist, as well as discuss future plans with the other chieftains. They'd only ruled the Frey Fortress for 4 days, and already there was talk of the coalition breaking up. Many saw the surrender of Alan Rist as a job well done, and a problem solved. She, Nephron, and the chieftains rode a wave of goodwill, but the men were tired of standing around and wanted to get back to their farms, livestock, wives, and children. What they didn't realize, what she needed to explain, was what Nephron had explained to her. This wasn't the end. It wasn't even the beginning. All they had done was shift position to higher ground. The first battle was still coming. Persephone had imagined the meeting would be similar to those she held at the lodge in Dal Ren, where a dozen men would gather around a fire and roast a lamb. She would sit in her chair and shout over the noise of belches and the bellows for more drink. If left to her, Persephone would have ordered a fire and a spit built, and a barrel of beer rolled out in the middle of the lower courtyard, an open space between the front gate and the general barracks. But she hadn't called the meeting. Nephron had. The Lord of the Rist, dressed in an uncharacteristically elegant long shirt, blue cape, and sporting gold arm and wristbands, escorted Persephone into the Verinthian. Tiers of seats climbed the walls like the sides of a giant bowl, granting everyone a clear view over the heads of those in front. Waiting for her were hundreds of men and Frey. Nephron led her down a central aisle that descended with wide steps to the bottom. Streaming shafts of sunlight entered through the strategically placed skylights, illuminating a raised dais. That's why he was so adamant about the time of the meeting. She had wanted it at night, but he insisted on just after midday.
Realizing that Nephron was leading her to that platform, she began to panic. This wasn't something she was used to. Persephone had experience speaking with a handful of familiar men, but this was another matter altogether. What's more, there was no chair. She'd always had a chair. The chair had been the greatest symbol of her position, more important than the torque. She felt diminished without it, smaller, as she was forced to stand before all those seated at a higher elevation. She didn't feel in command, but rather like an accused criminal brought forth for questioning. In the front row sat all the chieftains, including the Gula, alongside several dignified-looking Frey she'd never seen before. Moya was there too, bow in hand, standing just off to the side and out of the light. As the shield to the Kenig, only she bore a weapon. Moya didn't say a word as Persephone passed, but she expressed a wide-eyed exclamation that Persephone knew would have been a slew of profanity if the two had been alone. Nephron walked with her as she climbed the remaining series of platforms, but then he stopped. He, too, remained in the shadows, urging her to step forward to the white-hot column of light that entered at an angle and lit the stage. Pressing quivering hands against her sides, she took those five remaining steps. The moment she entered the light, the dome erupted in applause. The sound scared her nearly to death. She almost backed off, but forced herself to take deep breaths and straighten up. This is no time to be seen as a troll. She waited for the turmoil to calm, then opened her mouth. I am Persephone, the Kenig of the Ten Clans. She stopped, stunned. The sound of her voice boomed with godly volume and silenced any remaining applause. She hadn't even spoken that loudly. She looked around, bewildered. The dome, said someone in the second row. It was Malcolm, who pointed up. Stupidly, she looked above her, then smiled and nodded, and this time she mouthed the words, Thank you. Hardly a sound was made as the audience awaited her next syllable. A few people coughed, but the sound was muted, as if they were in another room. She swallowed and began again. I am Persephone, the Kenig of the Ten Clans, and I've called this meeting to explain a few things and to hear any problems or concerns you might have. Her voice wavered slightly, and she took another breath. The Instaria of Alenrist have graciously agreed to act as our hosts in our efforts to stand against the aggression of the Fane. Frey law, bestowed by their god Feral, prohibits them from taking another Frey life. As a result, they will not join our cause as active warriors, but they will also not seek to jeopardize or undermine it. She stared at the seven Frey in the front row, all of whom nodded. She smiled and nodded back. Step one complete. Now, a number of men have spoken to me about going home. They have fields that need attention, animals that need tending, and trust me, we need you to do those things. An army is only as good as its supply of food. Nephron had given her that line during their two-day preparation. Seeing the very serious nods of approval from both the Frey as well as the Gula, she understood why. Credibility. She was still earning it. We need you to keep farming. As much as I would like this victory to be the end of our troubles, it isn't. The first battle of this war has yet to be fought. Now that we've moved into his command fortress, the Fane must act. He will send a force to dislodge us. And make no mistake, that force will be powerful and determined. It will take
every last man, every sword, every ounce of will we have to weather it. But...
She paused, letting the thunder of her booming voice fade. We don't know when that day will come. It could be next week, or next year, and we can't afford to let fields lie fallow. So, here is my plan. I am told that Alan Rist already has a system of signal fires built between here and Irvanon, their outpost in the far north. I am ordering that we extend this system, building additional woodpiles in the High Spear Valley in the east and south to Tyre. In this way, many of you will be able to return home. But if scouts learn of an impending attack, I will order the signals to be lit. And this will be the sign for all able-bodied warriors to return.
There were fewer nods, but no one complained. Now, not everyone can go, and not everyone can stay when they get home. We need to train. Nephron, his Galantians, and many of their fellow Instaria have volunteered to teach us how to fight.
We already know how to fight,
one of the Gula shouted, but his voice was a mouse squeak compared to hers.
They can make us better, she said, and you'll become familiar with new weapons. My good friend Roan and a network of smiths trained by her will be working night and day to forge swords made of iron, a magical metal that is stronger than copper and bronze. She will also oversee the making of armor, shields, and helms.
What about the bow?
Someone farther back shouted.
Will we get to learn that?
Persephone looked at Moya and smiled.
Indeed. But it will require making hundreds of bows and thousands of arrows. Another reason why we need men to stay. We will work in shifts. I will send home groups of men for a month at a time. Then they will return, and others will leave. We'll make sure to stagger the groups, so every village will always have some men able to work communal fields. And I will establish supply routes using wagons to haul food, salt, wood, and wool.
More nods. Fewer folded arms.
We need to work together to prepare. We must remain committed to the path we've started down. It's essential that we trust one another. And if we can do that, together we will survive.
That was the end of her speech. But only Nephron knew it. So there was an awkward pause. Persephone wasn't certain what to do. In the past, she just sat back in her chair, drank from a cup, or began eating.
How does one get off this stage?
Nephron came to her rescue by clapping. This ignited applause in the audience. Sadly, Persephone noticed it, too, was muted.
Chapter 5 The Giant and the Hobgoblin.
Even to this day, we do not know much about Moandoulé, which is unfortunate, since I still can't decide whether, in the grand scheme of things, he was a hero or a villain.
The Book of Brin.
His name was Sile, and he went everywhere Thane Lothian did. Moandoulé couldn't remember the other one's name, the female. Not that he needed to. Both of his father's new bodyguards were silent watchers who weren't inclined to conversation. Sile was unusually large. Moandoulé would go so far as to call him grotesque, and he harbored doubts that the hulking guard was Frey at all. Sile had a large head, broad, and endowed with a protruding brow that cast shadows on his eyes. His jaw was a hinged shovel, and his ears lacked the traditional teardrop shape.
Wandulet secretly suspected Sile was a diminutive member of the Grimmorian race. He even carried a battle axe. Sile certainly wasn't